let's move ahead to Levy and add this cultural and intellectual response to all of this. I won't say it's more important in this case, but that this is our way to connect with what was taking place there. Now, Lev, how many of you had read this before? Oh, really? Just okay. Well, then I'm glad I assigned it. This was there. How many of you have read other books in high school or college that Knight? Knight's the one. Okay, so that's sort of this was the Knight before. In my time, we read this, and I think it might have been among the first to really come out. So this is served the same function, sort of an introduction to the whole process. And of course, it maybe is slightly deflected because it doesn't deal with Birkenau, it deals with Buna. So, but I think the themes that Levy articulated here had a tremendous amount of resonance with the intellectual frame of the time, and I want to emphasize that to a certain degree. Being the profound thinker that he was, chemist, but after this experience, much more, Levy had a lot of impact on the way people thought about Auschwitz and the Holocaust, and really the 20th century. And his ideas paralleled the existentialist turn that, although it pre-existed the Second World War and the Holocaust, became so dominant in the period after that. I don't think Levy went in this as an existentialist, but so many of his ideas and reflections on the experience in the camp seem to confirm that position. That it is a document both of the camps and of the impact that the camp experience had on Western mind. Now, the first preface, we have the page problem again, and I apologize for that. Same, company, and they don't tell me, therefore, that, it's a different pagination. So we'll have to do what we did before. Starting in the author's preface, which I believe is your page 9, okay. We hear that his goal in writing this wasn't just to lay out the events, but it should be rather to furnish documentation for a quiet study of certain aspects of the human mind. But this goes beyond just telling us what happened. It's a psychological or cultural history of the experience. Many people, many nations can find themselves holding, more or less wittingly, that every stranger is an enemy. For the most part, this conviction lies deep down like some latent infection. It betrays itself only in random, disconnected acts and does not lie at the base of a system of reason. So, most people may have enemies, but it doesn't become absolutely central to everything that you do. But when this does come about, when the unspoken dogma becomes the major premise in a syllogism, then at the end of the chain, there is the lager. And, this is just sort of drawing the conclusions from what we talked about the last 2 weeks with Mein Kampf, placing this enemy at the center of their worldview. And when you do that, then, although externally that may not be logical, internally it's logical, and the end point is the camps. If you identify a certain group as the cause of all of your problems, that's the first step toward actually eliminating them. Right. So he's really, I think he does put his finger right on the core of Nazi culture as I presented it to you. Right. Whatever the individual reasons for it, the effectiveness that this has, providing people with that clear central explanation and clear, simple solutions for very complicated problems. When you take the pill like that, then you can march in order and ultimately be unrepentant. Okay, So the first few pages, I won't go into as much detail as I might have, but we'll see what I can do. Do trace his arrest. And he was involved with resistance, although he tells us on page 9 that this was under armed and not well organized. So not a very effective resistance, but he is a resistor and arrested as such. And it was that he was actually surprised, in a way, on page 10, that it was really worse to be a Jew than to have been an active resistor. I believed wrongly, as was subsequently seen, that the admission of my political activity would have meant torture and certain death. But as a Jew, you know, that was even a worse issue. He was separated from those and put down in Fossili, where he is incarcerated with hundreds of other Jews being rounded up at that time. Okay. Down on at the bottom of page 10, we learn about the deportations that are beginning. All the Jews, without exception, even the children, even the old, even the ill. Our destination, nobody knew. We should be prepared for a fortnight of travel. For every person missing at the roll call, 10 would be shot. So this is the beginning of the deportations from Rome, from Italy, and the history of that I might have talked about, but I'm not going to into it except to say that there was no papal reaction to this at the time, which is even though the trains were leaving right from downtown Rome, that's a point of contention, as it were. Moving to page 12. Oh, sorry. Well, it's pretty tight. So the paragraph beginning, with the absurd precision to which we later had to accustom ourselves. 16. The Germans held the roll call. At the end, the officer asked, "Wie viel Stück?" The corporal saluted smartly and replied there were 651 pieces and that all was in order. So here we hear this language of the camp world, and Levy has a good ear for that. By the way, so does Victor Klemperer. Being a literary scholar, he very much concentrated on the language of the terror. And this treatment of the Jews as Stück, pieces, in a kind of industrial process. Things have moved to that point now. Bureaucratization of the thing. Bureaucratization to the point of dehumanization. They're just, you know, this is the language of the railroads. How many pieces are on there? How many pieces of cattle are on there? Right. So the bureaucratization leads to dehumanization. They're just dealing with these objects in a kind of industrial process by that time. And this is 43. So now, you know, we're well into this. The doors had been closed at once, but the train did not move until evening. 17. We had learned of our destination with relief, Auschwitz, a name without significance for us at that time, but it at least implied some place on this earth. So, right, you're getting carted off to Auschwitz. Right now, you're getting out of that train, right, no matter what. But back then, it didn't mean anything to them. They wanted to know where they were going, right? Your mind wants that kind of order. The train traveled slowly with long, unnerving halts. They saw the mountains disappear behind them, pass through the Brenner and so on. And actually, I had marked here just to talk about the train. You know, the fact that the trains were so much a part of this and the experience of transport and the fact that, this was something that was bought and paid for and planned. Right? So those people had to have some idea what was going on. Moving to the climax came suddenly, arriving at Auschwitz. 19. The door opened with a crash and the bar echoed with outlandish orders in that curt, barbaric barking of Germans in command which seems to give vent to a millennial anger. A vast platform appeared before us, lit up by reflectors. A little beyond it, a row of lorries, and everything was silent again. A dozen SS men stood around, legs akimbo, with an indifferent air. They did not interrogate everybody, only a few. How old? Healthy or ill? On the basis of the reply, they pointed in two different directions. So this process of selection taking place right at the entrance. Women, children, and elderly were pretty much selected automatically. You know, the powerful image of children being selected, and which continues to infuriate and triggers the argument. Okay, all right, the enemy, destroy the enemy. But why the kids? How could the kids have any interest? The SS guy says this in the movie. That kids are the particular problem. That's the future. It's the eugenic future. You see, this is a racial cleansing, medical cleansing. It's precisely the children that you have to get rid of, because they're the ones that are going to perpetuate the infestation, as they would see it. So that argument just doesn't work. If once, you know, you're dealing with someone who's accepted those principles and literally sees it in a kind of a medical clinical way. The children are the real pests, strangely. So, you know, there's no way to explain how they could stand there and look at these innocent, you know, 7-year-olds and put them and do what they did with them. But this is the way they saw it, for the most part.
Well, you said that women were obviously selected, but was there a women's camp at Auschwitz?
Yeah, right. Maybe not at Auschwitz. Well, women's section, that's right. Young women who could work, teenage women, 20s. But they weren't going to separate the mothers from the children, because mm-hmm. that's messy. Right, and this is up to this point. Remember, you know, the people who are on there, they don't know what's going to happen to them, right? So, and they want to keep it that way. They want to keep it smooth. They want to keep it calm and get it in there, because, I mean, besides just, you know, you don't want uprising. They don't want delay, and it just takes one person to freak out, and then you've got 20 people freaking out. And although they could certainly handle it, they don't want delay. This is a procedure that they have there, right? So they're not going to start pulling kids out of mother's hands. So if you're a mother, you would go that way. If you're a single woman, I'm just, mm-hmm. that's my impression. Mm-hmm. That would be my explanation for it. And the reason for it is that bureaucracy. Yeah. Because, I mean, they are able to keep up the lie right into the chamber. As he said, the kids are laughing and jumping before they get in there. It's probably not until people are in the chamber and the doors and it starts to get too tight that they start to really maybe admit what they may be guessing. But how can you acknowledge that? There is always that hope. You know? They behaved with the calm assurance of people doing their normal duty of every day. And when Renzo stayed an instant too long to say goodbye to his fiancée, with a single blow, they knocked him to the ground. It was their everyday duty. This is just what these soldiers did. Today, however, we know that in that rapid and summary choice, each one of us had been judged capable or not of working usefully for the Reich. We know that of our convoy, no more than 96 men and 29 women entered the respective camps of Monowitz, Buna, and Birkenau, and all of the others, more than 500 in number, not one was living two days later. So they went straight to the chambers. He gets it on the... this is why the 3-year-old Amelia died. His historical necessity of killing the children of Jews was self-demonstrative to the Germans. I said what I said before. But he even senses that. Now, instead two groups of strange individuals emerged into the light of the lamp. He's describing some people who've been there for a while. They walked in squads in rows of three with an odd, embarrassed step, head dangling in front, arms rigid. On their heads they wore comic berets and were all dressed in long striped overcoats, which even by night and from a distance looked filthy and in rags. They walked in a large circle around us, never drawing near and so forth. We looked at each other without a word. It was all incomprehensible and mad, but one thing we had understood. This was the metamorphosis that waited us. Tomorrow we would be like them. And this metamorphosis of transforming, you know, healthy, relatively healthy people who've been transported in, putting them in these uniforms which were too big, putting them in these wooden shoes that were just vicious on their feet, punishing them for, you know, not wearing those things properly and so forth. It was this metamorphosis constituted the realization of the theory, of the image, of the stereotype. They made these people look inhuman. They broke them down. And that's part of the process, at least retrospectively, it seems that it was part of the process of the psychology of the camps, which aided the perpetrators in the eradication program. Because they don't see these people as human after they've been worn down this way. So they end up being these bent over, broken Jewish stereotypes who hobble. Right? And part of the Jewish stereotype was that they didn't walk like the rest of us. Right? That they were these sort of nervous, you know, shambling creatures. And in the camps, they were reduced to that. So for those who were around there, these are those who were working, by the way, not those who were eliminated immediately. You know, they were surrounded. They could just look and say, look at these Jews. You know, they don't shave, and they smell, and they don't walk, and, you know, they're broken down. I mean, you're just killing off something that looks just like those stereotypical posters that have been around. On the bottom, and then I'll move to, now another German comes and tells us to put the shoes in a certain corner. 23. And we put them there, because now it is all over, and we feel outside this world, and the only thing is to obey. Someone comes with a broom and sweeps away all the shoes outside the door in a heap. He's crazy, he's mixing them up. 96 pairs, they will all be mixed up. And then below that, the second act begins. Four men with razors, soap brushes, and clippers burst in. So this gathering of all of their goods. We've seen the photographs of this, and I just mention it because it's very symbolic now to us, because if you go to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, they have this huge room of shoes. And that's one of the most powerful moments there. Because it just forces you to contemplate all those feet that were in there and the craziness of this. And then photographs of the big, huge, just barns full of hair that were left behind. Buttons and gold from teeth. I mean, that was, they were really after the gold from the teeth. If they wanted that gold, that was immediate. But, you know, they rendered these individuals the way you render cattle. You got everything out of them. And the hair was going to be used for pillows and I don't know what. Right? So they justified it in their way as a practical process. The gold had immediate value, but and I don't know what they were going to end up doing with all of these things or how much of it was actually processed, but it's part of this mechanical bureaucratization of the thing, that they seized all these things. Okay, we are at Monowitz, near Auschwitz. The whole thing's near Auschwitz. This camp is a work camp. In German, one says Arbeitslager. All the prisoners, there are about 10,000, work in a camp which produces a type of rubber called Buna. So the camp is itself called Buna, okay? And that's important because we see that distinction. And there was this cover of practical results under which the killing took place. And it's also part of why people think, well, even if you did know, they could say, well, you're going to work in this rubber factory. You know, there's a chance that that's where you're going to go to work. You could even fool yourself that that's what you're going to end up doing. So, I mean, I'm sure officially it was always just a rubber factory, right? Now, a page or so beyond that. Then for the first time, we became aware, okay, 26, that our language lacks words to express this offense, whatever that defense is. The demolition of a man, In a moment, with almost prophetic intuition, the reality was revealed to us. We had reached the bottom. It is not possible to sink lower than this. No human condition is more miserable than this, nor could it conceivably be so. Nothing belongs to us anymore. They have taken away our clothes, our shoes, even our hair. If we speak, they will not listen to us. And if they listen, they will not understand. They will even take away our name. And if we want to keep it, we will have to find in ourselves the strength to do so, to manage somehow so that behind the name of something of us as we were, still remains. So this is this general theme of this dehumanization of the victims, literally removing all of their physical belongings, but even their names. You see on the next page, they become a number. They have to answer to that number. The demolition of a man. And this whole process is, for Levy, beyond words. Words break down. Here. We are aware that our language lacks words to express this offense. And, of course, this is a major theme of the outlook that results from the Holocaust, that, you know, how can you explain what took place there? Same problem as the trenches of the First World War, right? But broadened in a sense, in that non-combatants were impacted with it this way. Imagine how a man who is deprived of everyone he loves, and at the same time of his house, his habits, his clothes, in short, of everything he possesses. He will be a hollow man, reduced to suffering and needs, forgetful of dignity and restraint, for he who loses all often easily loses himself. He will be a man whose life or death can be lightly decided with no sense of human affinity. So you've created something that you can easily destroy, right? Because that individual doesn't seem to exist even to himself anymore. In the most fortunate of cases, on the basis of a pure judgment of utility, just a shtuck. It is in this way that one can understand the double sense of the term extermination camp. You exterminate them physically, but before that you exterminate them in every other way. It is now clear what we seek to express with the phrase to lie in the bottom. Häftling. I have learned that I am a Häftling. My number is 174517. We have been baptized. We will carry the tattoo on our left arm until we die. So the symbolism of that, reducing them to these objects. Okay, so moving ahead to, you know, past the break at We Still and another page or so, we had soon learned that the guests of the lager are divided into three categories.
33.
All are clothed in the criminals, the politicals, and the Jews. Right, so here are those divisions that they exist within the camp, and you sort of know the history of it. The politicals would have been there for a while, some of them. All are clothed in stripes. All are hefting it. But the criminals wear a green triangle next to the number sewn on the jacket. The politicals wear a red triangle, and the Jews, who form the large majority, wear the Jewish star. SS men exist, but are few and outside the camp, and are seen relatively infrequently. So there's this hierarchy within the camp. Okay. And what's important about the last phrase is that a lot of the camp management was done by prisoners. Okay. On a day-to-day basis, not just the grunt work, but a lot of the structure wasn't determined, but was managed by other prisoners. Criminals being at the top, politicals being probably second, as kind of intellectually there, but the criminals would have been the smartest ones. And also the most vicious. And then, even within the Jewish realm, you know, those who had positions or took positions, and of course, this is the source of the moral dilemma, the moral relativism that Primo Levi is dealing with throughout the writing of this book and his subsequent books on the topic, and really to the end of his life. Now, he was a suicide. There's a tendency to say he died in ultimately out of despair, triggered by this. His family denied that. So I'll just say that that's not clear. But he was certainly troubled by the fact that he survived. Because to survive, have survived, meant that you had to be somewhat complicitous in the process. You survived because someone else didn't. You survived because you got a spoon and someone else didn't. You survived because you got a job inside the lab and someone else didn't. And his own sense of guilt on the basis of that, you know, helps to him to explain and articulate to us that even inside the camp, there's a lot of gray. There were German soldiers who were relatively kind, could show kindness. And there were Jews who were absolutely vicious and capable of incredible selfishness. So there's this breakdown of what you might expect. It is not black and white, even in the camp. We already knew in good part the rules of the camp, which are incredibly complicated. The prohibitions are innumerable: to approach nearer the barbed wire than 2 yards, to sleep with one's jacket or without one's pants or with one's caps on one's head, to use certain washrooms or latrines, not to go for a shower on the prescribed day. So there's all of this infinite and senseless bureaucracy at work there. And I mean, he sees this as a manifestation of the camp life, the camp universe as a whole. The value of it was these people were so focused on all of these details. Their existence was reduced to complying with these things for the most part. It was the only thing that they could do, at least most of them. I mean, in order to survive, he tells us later, you couldn't just follow it. If you didn't cheat at all, you couldn't survive. It would just wear you down if you did absolutely everything they told you. But you had to be very careful about it, and you had to be wily in order to get through that. So it had the effect of distracting, essentially, the human soul. The human soul was focused purely on complying with all of these little rules. There wasn't room for your mind to go anywhere. Now, whether that was by design or just simply the way it evolved, again, intentionalist or functionalist. Okay, let's move past initiation. To the washroom is far from attractive. 39. It is badly lighted, full of drafts, with the brick floor covered by a layer of mud. The water is not drinkable. It has a revolting smell and often fails for many hours. The walls are covered by curious didactic frescoes, though. Posters, I would say. For example, there is the good heftling, portrayed stripped to the waist, about to diligently soap his sheared and rosy cranium, and the bad heftling, with a strong Semitic nose and a greenish color, bundled up in his stained clothes with a beret on his head. Under the first, like this you are clean, and under the second, like this you come to a bad end. And in lower down, in doubtful French, cleanliness is holiness. Those stereotypes are even being applied inside the camp, right? There's the clean Jew and the dirty Jew, right? And that whole notion of stereotyping the enemy as that dirty Jew, and it's even applied within the camp. I just thought that was noteworthy. At the end of this chapter, it grieves me now. But then he turns to, precisely because the lager was a great mean machine to reduce us to beasts, he felt we must not become beasts. Even in this place one could survive, and therefore one must want to survive, to tell the story, to bear witness. To survive we must force ourselves to save at least the skeleton, the scaffolding, the form of civilization. This is the motivation for complying to some degree. Someone's got to survive. And to do it, it really meant living according to these rules as much as you could. We must certainly wash our faces without soap and dirty water and dry ourselves in the jacket. We must polish our shoes, not because the regulation states it, but for dignity and propriety. We must walk erect without dragging our feet, not in homage to Prussian discipline, but to remain alive, not to begin to die. So here's that tension. You know, you would think, oh, you would just want to do nothing that they want to tell you. They tell you to do. You don't want to live up to these things that they've imposed on you, but you have to in order to survive. So he's caught in that dilemma all the time. Okay, let's move ahead to Kabe, and about three pages from the end of that chapter. So, da Italiana does not believe in selections.
52.
I understand him with difficulty. Show me your number. You are 174517. This numbering began 18 months ago and applies to Auschwitz and the dependent camps. There are now 10,000 of us here at Buna, perhaps 30,000 between Auschwitz and Birkenau. Where are the others? So he's right there, and he doesn't know. Perhaps transfer to other camps, I suggest. Shmulek shakes his head. He doesn't want to understand. So there's that point where we know, even though he's only been there for a little while, but we know we learn here that he doesn't really know what's going on just down the road, or doesn't want to believe it. That's possible too. Okay, let's move ahead to A Good Day, the chapter A Good Day, After Nights and Our Work. What page is that? 71? Okay, so about a page and a half into that. The Buna is not. The Buna is desperately and essentially opaque and gray. It is not green, that is. It is not green. It is essentially opaque and gray. This huge entanglement of iron, concrete, mud, and smoke is the negation of beauty. Its roads and buildings are named like us, by numbers or letters, or by weird and sinister names. Within its bounds, not a blade of grass grows, and the soil is impregnated with the poisonous saps of coal and petroleum. And the only things alive are machines and slaves. The former are more alive than the latter. I underline this because for all of that romantic culture of National Socialism, incorporating the 19th century tradition of mountains and skies and clouds and storms and rivers and all of that, what they really produced, the only true cultural product of Nazism, was this: the utter negation of that romantic culture. The realization of the nightmare that the Romantics were warning against by emphasizing nature, completely denuding nature of any beauty, and of course reducing individuals to machine-like slaves. So in the long haul, this is the end point of that, and I think the irony of it is pretty clear. So roughly the next page or so. For human nature is such that grief and pain, even simultaneously suffered, do not add up as a whole in our consciousness, but hide the lesser behind the greater, according to a definite law of perspective. In fact, it is not a question of human incapacity for a state of absolute happiness, but an ever insufficient knowledge of the complex nature of the state of unhappiness, so that the single name of the major cause is given to all its causes, which are composite and set out in an order of urgency. And if the most immediate cause of stress comes to an end, you are grievously amazed to see that another one lies behind, in reality, a whole series of others. Here we're getting some of this existentialist language, right? The point is, you know, existence is not a series of, or even a quest for happiness. It's just an experience of various grades of unhappiness, one after another. Of course, this becomes very clear to him in the camps. Now, on page, the next chapter is called This Side of Good and Evil, which is a clear reference to Nietzsche, Beyond Good and Evil, but he's showing us, you know, it's we're still here. And what follows is a whole chapter on the market that exists within the camp for stolen items. So the whole process of stealing from one another, what it takes to survive, and so forth. But more important, in conclusion, at the end of this chapter, before the drowned and the saved, theft in Buna, punished by the civil direction, is authorized and encouraged by the SS. Theft in camp, severely repressed by the SS, is considered by the civilians as a normal exchange operation. Theft among Häftlinge is generally punished, but the punishment strikes the thief and the victim with equal gravity. So that there's this very complicated order there, you know. There's no clear morality from above, right, but even from within. We now invite the reader to contemplate the possible meaning of the log in the logger of the words good and evil, just and unjust. Right? They don't have any meaning anymore. It's a completely morally relativistic place. Just whatever is necessary at any particular moment. And really, within that framework, you can't be sure. Right? At one point, this is the right thing to do, and at another point, it's the wrong thing to do. It's constantly fluctuating. And this is where existentialists will draw from Nietzsche, and then Foucault will press things even further, this relative nature of power and morality. Let everybody judge on the basis of the picture we have outlined and of the examples given above how much of our ordinary moral world could survive on this side of the barbed wire.
Okay, let's pick up at the chapter headed The Drowned and the Saved. This is really the core of the book, and in fact, he would go ahead and write another essay, which published as a book, with this title, The Drowned and the Saved. And it's in this section that he really lays out some of these essentially existentialist concepts that will haunt him and really haunt the immediate period around the Holocaust. The themes that we're looking for throughout the text here are clearly those of racial anti-Semitism, the distinguished the actual being of individuals rather than their outlook as indicative of their Jewishness, and that's the basis for their being there and being treated the way they are. Secondly, the specific process of Jewish policy and the history of that, so those elements of the story that coordinate with the events and decisions and policies that we ran through at the beginning of our coverage of this. All the elements of dehumanization, how the prisoners were reduced to something other than human beings, really beasts in some level, which made it difficult for them to respond and easier for the perpetrators to manage their business, since these creatures that resulted really appear to be the equivalent of the stereotypes that had been publicized through the propaganda from the beginning of the regime on, and really from the end of the 19th century on. Or something even less, simply cogs in some sort of a process, pieces in some sort of industrial program. Then comes the issue which is really central to Primo Levi's view of his experience there, and that was the extent to which victims were actually forced by circumstances to be complicit in their own punishment, in their own destruction. And this ranges from those who were actually collaborating in order to survive for themselves as authorities within the camp, or simply having a job within the camp, or to the extent which they complied with the rules in order to survive, or simply did what they had to do in some sort of a competitive process of surviving, just getting what food they needed, and that often meant that someone else would not get that food, making sure they had the utensils they needed, getting the bed that they needed, whatever that was. Levi sees that all as levels of complicity among the victims, and that leads to his general sense that morality is completely relative within the camps. And he refers, perhaps not in this text, but in the essay on the drowned and the saved, the next publication, to this notion of a gray zone, where there isn't a good or evil, there isn't a just or unjust, as the last chapter concluded, within the camps, that you simply can't use those standards. So, referring back to Nietzsche, you're in a world that where those concepts just don't apply. And it's that kind of thinking that will influence the period as a whole with existentialist concepts that are similar. Other elements of existential thought that you can definitely see coming through Levi's perception of his camp experience are the limits of language. We talked a little bit about that, the inability to communicate what really took place, especially the horrors of the Holocaust that are taking place around him. And the fact that language itself is twisted in the camps. Words like good and evil, for instance, but even comfort and discomfort and so forth, just don't have the same meaning within this context, within this framework. So it shows that language itself is something that's malleable. And this has real impact on existentialist thinking, what comes to be known as structuralist thinking after the war, which argues that language is something that is not immediate, not complete. It is just an estimate of what you're experiencing or trying to articulate, and words have meaning only with reference to that experience. It's a very imperfect tool. And again, this is something that does go back to Nietzsche's writings and has its influence through the 20th century. And I mention Nietzsche simply because it's pretty clear that Primo Levi is aware of that with his title, On This Side of Good and Evil, and other passages that seem to refer to Nietzsche's writings, as do many of the philosophies of the existentialist movement, including Sartre and Camus. Also, you have, through this book and extending beyond it, this notion that existence comes first, survival comes first. There's just this animal level of being, and all other elements of what we consider to be human nature, whether it be morality, or high culture are simply additions to that that are only possible if the conditions for existence are satisfied. And the man that goes into this camp is reduced to that elementary level of existence before essence. This is also consistent with existentialism, which is basically arguing that we lose track of the fact that that is the base what human experience teaches. Another comparable theme that runs through Levy's work is that of the individual as being utterly alone. This operates externally in the sense that camp captives are forced to look out for themselves, and they do not, perhaps surprisingly, they do not unite as a group. There isn't any sense of unity against their issues. They are all atomized, like atoms, singled out, and have to survive alone. Of course, they have been, for the most part, separated from their families, but no friendships are developed within the camp. It's too tenuous. Existence is too tenuous. Any associates they have in this experience, they have to keep at arm's length simply because they'll probably lose them fairly soon. And in fact, each of those individuals are competitors for the requirements of survival. And then generally, an overall sense of hopelessness. One simply cannot think of the future. One can only deal with the issues that are at hand, with the experience that you immediately face. We'll see here, he talks about an ironic joke, which is any hope for some sort of change in the future, any sort of hope for some policy, they would just joke, yeah, that's going to happen first thing in the morning, Morgenfogel in German. And that's meant very ironically, that you simply can't expect anything and you just have to deal with the experiences as it comes. So concentrating on immediate circumstances and not thinking about the future and at the higher level, general sense of hopelessness. So those are the main themes that I want to draw from the text as a whole, and a lot of them come out very strongly in this immediate section, starting with the chapter heading, The Drowned and the Saved. He opens by asking whether there's anything that possibly can be learned from the camp experience. What we have said so far, and will say, concerns the ambiguous life of the lager. In our days, many men have lived in this cruel manner, crushed against the bottom, but each for a relatively short period, so that we can perhaps ask ourselves if it is necessary or good to retain any memory of this exceptional human state. So, was there anything to be derived from this experience? What are the lessons of this process? To this question, we feel that we have to reply in the affirmative. Yes, there are things that can be learned from the camps. We are in fact convinced that no human experience is without meaning or unworthy of analysis, and that fundamental values, even if they are not positive, can be deduced from this particular world which we are describing. We would also like to consider that the lager was preeminently a gigantic biological and social experiment. So, he does believe that there's something to be gained from this, and fundamentally, I would say it is that principles that we'll just generally refer to as existentialist, they're not coming out of that philosophical school. he's not associated with Sartre or Camus or any of the others, but many of the themes that he's articulating as lessons that come from this experiment do parallel those that they were arguing coming from different perspective or position. Thousands of individuals differing in age, condition, origin, language, culture, and customs are enclosed within barbed wire. There they live a regular, controlled life which is identical for all and inadequate to all needs, and which is much more rigorous than any experimenter could have set up to establish what is essential at what and what adventitious to the conduct of the human animal in the struggle for life. So this essentials are revealed here. All of the trappings of culture, high culture, civilization, government, religion, all of that is removed. And in essence, that's what the theory of the existentialist is trying to get at. Can, you know, what is the core of human existence? Next paragraph, a little further down. We believe that the only conclusion to be drawn is that in the face of driving necessity and physical disabilities, many social habits and instincts are reduced to silence. So a lot of the socialized things disappear under these conditions. You really strip down and find out what the core of mankind really is. But another fact seems to us worthy of attention. There comes to light the existence of two particularly well-differentiated categories among men, the saved and the drowned. Other pairs of opposites, the good and the bad, the wise and the foolish, the cowards and the courageous, the unlucky and the fortunate, are considerably less distinct. They seem less essential, and above all, they allow for more numerous and complex intermediary gradations. So, I mean, what's essential is whether you're saved or drowned, whether you make it, both physically and psychologically. You could survive, but not survive psychologically. Can you survive and hold something together? Or do you drown, either physically or psychologically, and just disappear as a being? So survival is the essence. You must make it. That's the measure of existence. If this division is much less evident in ordinary life, for there it rarely happens that a man loses himself. A man is normally not alone in this sense, and in his rise or fall is tied to the destinies of his neighbors. So it is exceptional for anyone to acquire unlimited power or to fall by succession of defeats into utter ruin. So it's rare that you have a situation that really brings this essence to the fore. Moreover, everyone is normally in possession of such spiritual, physical, and even financial resources that the probabilities of a shipwreck, of total inadequacy in the face of life, are relatively small, and one must take into account a definite cushioning effect exercised both by the law and by the moral sense which constitutes a self-imposed law. For a country is considered the more civilized, the more the wisdom and efficiency of its laws hinder a weak man from becoming too weak, or a powerful one too powerful. So society buffers against the real truth of human existence, right? That is revealed in camp experience and as well as existentialist philosophy. But in the lager, things are different. Here, the struggle to survive is without respite because everyone is desperately and ferociously alone. Right? And that, although it's not a quote, but it echoes Sartre arguing, we are alone. Meaning alone vis-a-vis other men, and also alone in the universe, not supported by some sort of spiritual framework. A further paragraph down. In history and in life, one sometimes seems to glimpse a ferocious law which state, to he that has will be given, to he that has not will be taken away. In the lager, where man is alone and where the struggle for life is reduced to its primordial mechanism, this unjust law is openly in force, is recognized by all. Right. So it's not just only the strong will survive, but it's those who have advantages will survive. and those who take advantage of those advantages are the only ones who will make it. Now the examples that he provides for those who have those advantages appear on page 81 in Mind, starting with the paragraph, "The result of this pitiless process of natural selection." And he says that those results could be read in the statistics of the Lager population movements. At Auschwitz in 1944, of the old Jewish prisoners, kleine Nummer, low numbers, less than 150,000, only a few hundred had survived. Not one of those who had survived was an ordinary häftling, vegetating in the ordinary commandos, subsisting on the normal ration. There remained only the doctors, tailors, shoemakers, musicians, cooks, young attractive homosexuals, friends or compatriots of some authority in the camp, or they were particularly pitiless, vigorous, and inhuman individuals installed in the posts of Kapos, Blockälteste, etc. Or finally, those who, without fulfilling particular functions, had always succeeded through their astuteness and energy in successfully organizing, gaining in this way, besides material advantages and reputation, the indulgence and esteem of the powerful people in the camp. Whosoever does not know how to become an organizer, combiner, or prominent, soon becomes a Musulman. In life, a third way exists, and is in fact the rule. It does not exist in the concentration camp. So here's the core of that sense of complicity. It's only those who served the system in some way, doctors, tailors, musicians, cooks, kapos, block leaders, or were particularly ruthless and efficient in managing their personal affairs, who were able to make it. So this is where that gray zone, that moral gray zone, kicks in. And of course, Levy's problem is that he felt that he was guilty of that, even though, you know, he certainly wasn't any of the worst of those cases, but just by virtue of having had the opportunity to get into the lab, as he will a little further on here, that was the basis for his survival. Those who simply followed the rules, did what they were told to do, and didn't have any of these advantages were eradicated, probably psychologically first, physically second, and ultimately weakened to the point where they were destroyed. A little further on, let's see, end of the next long paragraph. Their life is short, but their number is endless. They, the Muslimena, the drowned, form the backbone of the camp, an anonymous mass, continually renewed and always identical, of non-men who march and labor in silence, the divine spark dead within them, already too empty to really suffer. One hesitates to call them living. One hesitates to call their death death, in the face of which they have no fear, as they are too tired to understand. So it's those that the system just eats away. To the extent that they're alert at all, they're just concentrating on those immediate needs and following those immediate rules, and they don't have that moral indifference that's necessary to make it. About a page further, we get a paragraph that talks about the lack of solidarity, the lack of camaraderie, the fact that individuals remain isolated, atomized, in the midst of all of this. He's talking about distinction between these prominents and everyone else, particularly, but this line is telling. We are aware that this is very distant from the picture that is usually given of the oppressed who unite, if not in resistance, at least in suffering. And he's arguing that there wasn't even unity in suffering under these circumstances. We do not deny that this may be possible when oppression does not pass a certain limit, or perhaps when the oppressor, through inexperience or magnanimity, tolerates or favors it. But we state that in our days, in all countries in which a foreign people have set foot as invaders, an analogous position of rivalry and hatred among the subjected has been brought about. And this, like many other human characteristics, could be experienced in the lager in the light of particularly cruel evidence. So they do not band together. Of course, this could be a point where one could discuss whatever record there is of resistance. It's small, to be sure. There are efforts to highlight those points when Jews in particular did stand up. There were a couple of revolts inside camps, a few individual cases of resistance, and incredibly brave, of course, but faded to obliteration. The force that they were up against is just overwhelming, and their resources were so small. Probably most important here is the uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto, and it's such a tragic story, but certainly emblematic of the fact that the Jews did not just take it and lie down and take it. There, some young, active organizers were able to put together a stand, and of course the tragedy is that they timed it for the arrival of Russian troops. When the Russians got wind of what was taking place in the Warsaw ghettos, they just halted their advance, waited till the Germans had eliminated these problematic forces inside the Warsaw, and then only continued their advance after the uprising had been destroyed. So these people were caught in between the grips of a vice that gave them no chance. Now, the next couple of sections you can read through. He provides four examples of the kind of people who did survive and maintain their integrity, and that's just plays out some of these themes. The next is just description of his being considered for the job as a chemist. I'll just turn and talk a little bit over the top of the chapter called The Canto of Ulysses, which is really a poignant reminder of what happens to high culture under these circumstances. He's an educated individual, obviously, and here we have him trying to remember a particular section of literature, and it simply comes to him in little snippets, little blips. It's been embodied. It's been deconstructed in his mind. Now, you know, for us, it's hard enough to remember our email passwords, but the previous generations did commit great literature, great poetry to memory. So the fact that he isn't able to hold on to that, even though we would probably have more difficulty holding on to it than he does there, but to him that's an indication that high culture was dissolving in the face of all of this. I would say that's part of the dehumanization process. If the definition of human is someone who is familiar with the humanities and has some sense of the higher things, such as good literature, good art, and good music, that has been stripped even within his mind. Now, moving to the next chapter, The Events of the Summer, I have underlined in the second paragraph, the end of the second paragraph, that as old Häftlinge, old captives, our wisdom lay in not trying to understand, not imagining the future, not tormenting ourselves as to how and when it would all be over, not asking others or ourselves any questions. And here's that reduction to the existence, pure existence. Also that sense of hopelessness. You just cannot allow yourself to think about the future. You simply have to deal with that which is in front of you. You cannot torment yourself by wondering when it would all be over. And this is in August of 1944. To us, we might say, well, there's just a few months left, and were they aware of that? Well, you still have to survive every day, and if you're sick, it doesn't matter if it's the Germans are around or the Russians are around. You are starving and or you're sick or whatever else. Obviously, the immediate fears will change, but as the end of the story tells us, those prisoners who were left behind and not forced to go on the death marches still barely got by. Other problems arise, other problems of just feeding themselves and keeping themselves warm and so on, and staying clear of illness. So all of this is the message is the wisdom of the camp and the wisdom of the period, if the wisdom of the responses to the camps and so on, is that we can all only live for the day and manage the best we can from moment to moment. On the next page, around, let's see, starting but with the after the gap, in August of 1944, the bombardments of Upper Silesia began, and they continued with irregular pauses and renewals throughout the summer and the autumn until the definitive crisis. But the monstrously unanimous labor of gestation of the Buna stopped brusquely and at once degenerated into a disconnected, frantic, and paroxysmal confusion. The day on which the production of synthetic rubber should have begun, which seemed imminent in August, was gradually postponed until the Germans no longer spoke about it. Constructive work stopped, the power of the countless multitudes of slaves was directed elsewhere, and day by day showed itself more riotous and passively hostile. At every raid there was new damage to be repaired. The delicate machinery, assembled with care just before, had to be dismantled again and evacuated. Air raid shelters and walls had to be hurriedly erected to show themselves at the next test as ironically ineffective as sandcastles. So here's the impact of the bombings that did take place. It obviously slowed down production at this camp, but didn't really change the conditions of existence for these people. Ironically, or perhaps tragically, somewhere here, I don't have the page in front of me, he indicates that no rubber was ever produced. They never got to production stage. At this IG Farben chemical plant with Auschwitz. So in the end, it really was an empty exercise, providing some sort of justification, I guess, in terms of the practical value of the camps. But really, it was just an excuse for the process at some level. Moving ahead to the chapter entitled October 1944, we have a section where he communicates this sense that language was opaque and not the words used in one context simply don't apply in others, particularly this one. Third paragraph, just as our hunger is not that feeling of missing a meal, so our way of being cold has need of a new word. We say hunger. We say tiredness, fear, pain. We say winter, and they are different things. They are free words created and used by free men who lived in comfort and suffering in their homes. If the lagers had lasted longer, a new harsh language would have been born. And only this language could express what it means to toil the whole day in the wind, with the temperature below freezing, wearing only a shirt, underpants, cloth jacket, and trousers, and in one's body nothing but weakness, hunger, and knowledge of the end drawing nearer. There is no language for really communicating that, and none of us can begin to comprehend what those individuals went through, because even if we read Night, even if we read this text, the tool of words doesn't transfer those experiences directly and completely enough. J. just a couple more sections, and they really deal with the ultimate theme of hopelessness. Moving ahead to the chapter entitled Kraus, K-R-A-U-S, and then going in, well, 2 pages or so, we have a paragraph that starts, "Now we leave," and then further on, this expression of the inability to think ahead. "We know that tomorrow will be like today. Perhaps it will rain a little more or a little less. Or perhaps instead of digging soil, we will go and unload trucks at the carbide factory. Or the war might even finish tomorrow. Or we might all be killed or transferred to another camp. Or one of those great changes might take place which, ever since the lager has been the lager, have been indefatigably foretold as imminent and certain. But who can seriously think about tomorrow? Memory is a curious instrument. Ever since I have been in the camp, 2 lines written by a friend of mine a long time ago have been running through my mind. Until one day, there will be no more sense in saying tomorrow. It is like that here." Do you know how one says never in camp slang? Morgen früh, tomorrow morning. In other words, ironically, if you say, we're going to, I hope we have warm food sometime soon. Someone looked at them and said, right, first thing tomorrow, morgen früh, right? And that just means no. So discussion of future actually is ironically a code for never in this environment. Let's just go to the end. I think you can find examples of these themes through the book and highlight those that I provided so far. But even in the last stages, even as the Russians are arriving and so forth, on the last few pages of the text, there's this sense of bleakness. Going to the end of the last chapter, the story of 10 days, and then back about 2 pages, turn to the paragraph which starts, "We all said to each other that the Russians would arrive soon, at once. We all proclaimed it. We were all sure of it. But at bottom, nobody believed it. Because one loses the habit of hoping in the lager, and even of believing in one's own reason. In the lager, it is useless to think, because events happen for the most part in an unforeseeable manner. And it is harmful because it keeps alive a sensitivity which is a source of pain and which some providential natural law dulls when suffering passes a certain limit. In some senses, this is the core message of this existentialist view. If you concern yourself with human nature, with some sort of a larger plan, with even possibly better future for yourself or for society as a whole, you're simply intensifying the suffering that you're going through now because you're comparing your existence presently to some sort of imaginary future that has no guarantee. So it is better to, or it is more genuine or more true or more consistent with the essence of existence to simply concentrate on that which you need to do day by day, hour by hour. And this is manifested or articulated most famously in Albert Camus' reference to the myth of Sisyphus, that human existence is just like that of the mythological figure who is condemned to rolling a rock up a hill, only to see that rock roll back down the hill as soon as he's done with that stage and having to go back and start it over. Camus does not see that as horrible, although he sees it as tragic, but he sees it as ennobling. Once the individual is aware of that, then he can deal with his fate honorably, we might say. And that might be the most that could be drawn from the camp experience.